Welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Serena. I am your host, and this is the Arts Report. So thank you for listening. Today is Wednesday, May 1st, and I'm broadcasting to you live from UBC campus, which is stolen, unceded Musqueam territory. I have a couple interviews for you today. First up is an interview with the lovely Charlotte Cornfield, a singer-songwriter from Toronto, Montreal, who's recently on tour with Al Menny from Seattle. And Charlotte is one of my favorite singers, so I was very, very excited to do this interview. You can hear it in the interview. It's pretty obvious that I was excited. But yeah, what an honor. And her latest release, Could Have Done Anything, is coming up on 1 year. So everyone go give it a listen. Anyways, here is that interview. Thanks for listening. All right, I'm here today with Charlotte Cornfield from Toronto, I believe.
Yes.
So yes. An amazing Canadian singer-songwriter. Would you call yourself singer-songwriter?
Yeah.
Okay, sweet. I would call you that. And I am so stoked to be here. You're on tour for your album. It's been out for about a year now,
yep.
Right? So what was the reception to that like?
Yeah, it's been really sweet. I put out the record 3 weeks after having a baby, so...
Oh my gosh.
It's been a very wild time in my life.
Yeah.
We started going on the road like when my daughter was about 3 months, and... yeah, the reception to the record's been really warm, and it just feels so good to be out playing shows.
Yeah, totally. How's the tour been going so far? I guess, like, kind of a crazy origin of it, but
yeah.
It's been, so how long have you been on tour for then?
We've been out for a couple of weeks, and yeah, it's been really fun. My two bandmates are two people, Steve and Kate, who I've known for like 20 years, and my partner and our daughter are with us, so it's just real family vibes, and we're touring with Al Menny, who's an amazing artist, originally from Seattle, but now based in LA, and he's amazing, and his band is so sweet, so it's just been, like, really fun.
Just feeling loved up.
Yeah.
Just, like, got the whole crew going.
Yeah.
That's so awesome. My favorite song from the record is In From the Rain, and I just wanted to, I guess, ask about some of the backstory to that, or, like, where that came from.
Totally. Well, I'm so glad you like that song. I think that's one of my faves from the record. Yeah, it's just kind of about, like, the evolution of a friendship and, like, choosing to not get hung up on the little hang-ups and differences and little fights and kind of, like, step back and see it all for what it is and appreciate the love that's there and, like, the things that you really get from it. And, yeah, it's kind of a character study, and I like... doing that because I just like digging into little details and so yeah, I had a lot of fun writing that song.
Sweet. Yeah, I feel like your lyricism is really good at like I read this thing one time about journalism, and it's like, oh, if you need to, you know, capture something big, write small. And I feel like obviously outsider's perspective, but you're really good at writing small and like kind of picking out those little details, and like I feel like In From the Rain really had like a good grasp on that writing spot. So I just wanted to commend you and be like, okay, sweet. Do you have any other music in the works right now, or are you contemplating any?
I am, yeah, I'm writing, and I will be making another record soon. Yeah, it's been really fun and interesting to kind of explore the creative process, like, with a kid now, and I have to be more directed about my time when it comes to writing, but it's also just this really fruitful and inspiring time, and, and just, yeah, it's really fun.
So do you think the new record will be a lot more about, like, motherhood and, like,
I think that will
having
be,
a child?
I think that will inform it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like, inevitably.
Extent, yeah. I don't know to what extent the songs will be about that, but it's all kind of still taking shape.
Sweet, yeah. How do you feel like your, I guess, I don't want to say career, but, like, your evolution has happened? Because you're on your fifth
record
release.
Yeah. It's been, for me, it's been a really kind of, like, I've been doing this for over 15 years now, and feels like this long, slow burn that keeps getting, like, more and more fun, and more and more people keep coming to shows, and it's felt very, like, manageable, and then also exciting, and I'm very, like, grateful to, be still building an audience and have new people coming out all the time. It's, it's feeling really good.
Sweet. Totally. What are you listening to these days? I feel like that's such a crucial question to ask.
Great question. I think my favorite record of the last year is self-titled by Greg Mendez from Philly. He's a really incredible Philly songwriter, and his album, just every song is amazing. I really love Adrian Lenker's new album, Bright Future. Totally. I think it's super brilliant. I've been in the van, we've been listening to the new Yard Act album. They're just hilarious and great. And then, I really love it. Leo Nascentelli's record, Another Side, which was reissued last year or the year before, is one we listened to a lot in the van. We're listening to William Onuwor today.
Nice!
Yeah.
I love William Onuwor.
Yeah,
that's
so
crazy.
Good.
Yeah.
So, those are some of the
Totally. Yeah. How many more shows do you have left on the tour?
So this is the last show of this West Coast tour.
Okay, sweet.
And then Steve, my drummer, and I are hopping on tour in a few days with Chastity Belt.
Sweet.
From Seattle. We're doing 9 shows with them, kind of like Eastern US and Toronto. So
just like go.
It's go for a month. I'm kind of halfway through. I'm like, okay, waking up at 6 every day with baby, playing every night. It's a lot, but
it's the dream.
It's fun. It's fun. Yeah.
Do you think you can, like, do it forever? Is it sustainable?
I wouldn't. I'm not the kind of person who's on the road all the time. Mm-hmm. So I think in little bursts I could do it. Mm-hmm. But I definitely wouldn't want to be on the road for most of the year.
So what does your life, I guess, look like more when you're not on the road? What is your creative process there?
I live in the West End of Toronto with my partner and our kid. And we have a great community there. And this past year I've been spending my days with her and just exploring and doing fun stuff and continuing to write and play and connect and just look forward to doing all of that.
What calls you to, like, songwriting or making music specifically as, like, an artistic outlet?
I think strong emotions do, but now it's kind of like, at this point in my life, it's more of a choice. It's, I need to, like, choose or find the space to enter that creative world, and then things start calling to me. So, but yeah, I would say travels, human interaction, seismic life events, all of these things kind of inform the writing process. Yeah.
Okay, well, best of luck on the tour. Best of luck on your show tonight. I'm so excited to be here for that. I'm stoked. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me today.
Thank you so
much.
I
really appreciate it.
It's been really nice chatting.
Thank you. All right, so that was my interview with Charlotte Cornfield that I was very excited about, obviously. And now we're going to listen to In From the Rain, which is one of my favorite songs from the record we were talking about. So stay tuned for that.
The sun sets on your new farmhouse out of town. Never saw this life for you, but we don't really talk much anymore. I linger at the end of the line, waiting for you to say something, but you don't have much to say to me anymore. You came
Summer Safety Week is May 1 to 7. As you plan your camping and hiking trips for the season, the Canada Safety Council wants you to be well equipped to stay safe on the trails and in the wild. Learn more about how you can best plan for a safe outdoor excursion, including how to make smart choices about clothing, food, and hydration at CanadaSafetyCouncil.org.
Doxa Documentary Film Festival returns May 2nd to 12th, 2024. Audiences of all ages are invited to 10 days of curiosity and critical thought in film. For 22 years, Doxa continues to present both short and feature films from across Canada and the globe, representing some of the best in documentary cinema. This year, Doxa is once again returning to local theaters in Vancouver and will feature live discussions, workshops, and other industry networking events with filmmakers. Visit doxafestival.ca for tickets, and we hope to see you there.
This is CITR 101.9 FM, and you just heard In From the Rain by Charlotte Cornfield. And coming up next, you're going to be hearing an interview with David Ng from Love Intersections, an queer activist organization in Vancouver. So thank you so much, David, for coming on my show today. You were a great guest. I was very lucky to have you. So here is that interview. And I'm here today with my lovely guest, David, from Love Intersections. David, if you'd like to say hi.
Hi, yeah, thanks for having me. Yeah. My name's David, he, him pronouns, core artistic director of Love Intersections, a media arts collective of queer artists of color and based in Vancouver. I'm also a PhD student at the Social Justice Institute at UBC.
And thank you so much for coming here today. I know I'm very lucky to have you, and I've also had you as an instructor as well, so I'm double lucky for that. Would you like to kind of introduce Love Intersections and what you guys do with the work that you're doing?
Sure. So I know I mentioned that I still call ourselves a media arts collective. Love Intersections grew out of a desire to use storytelling and arts to make interventions on, it started off with racism that we were experiencing from within the queer community. And it sort of has grown into using art and cultural production as a way to make social change. We've now expanded into installation, other types of visual artwork. We also call ourselves mainly social practice artists now as well, largely because a lot of what we do is working closely with community. Of course, because of the capitalist or colonial world that we live in, only certain parts of the artwork is legible.
Right.
So we think of our work as 80% community engagement. And then sometimes through that process of working in collaboration with community, there's sometimes an artistic output. So like that 15 to 20%. But a lot of the work is relationships, which is a big part of our work.
Yeah, that's like a really interesting way to think about that work. And I feel like I have heard before, and not like necessarily from anybody that I've talked to on this show, but I have heard before of that idea of kind of like, how does what we're producing and like what is visible and people like, you know, understand as like being part of our brand or whatever, how does that compare to like all of the behind the scenes work and like the work that maybe we're doing in more of a like passion driven way, or like, okay, this is what the message is, but then this is only what you see. Like, this is the, you know, gallery exhibit of all the background work.
Totally. And especially because, you know, we do our main, we started off doing short documentary. It's still what we do.
Cool.
And, you know, we tell stories that are often not our own. And so we've gone through, and we just celebrated our 10-year anniversary.
Oh my gosh, congratulations.
2 months ago. But it's been a 10-year journey of really, you know, how do we tell other people's stories to address issues of systemic racism, but in a way that honors people's stories. Because, you know, in the worst examples of documentary filmmaking, you really just sort of extract someone's story, edit it to your, you know, to the way that you want it. And then that's it, right? Because they signed a release form. And we really want to work on the complete opposite of that. And so in thinking of how do we honor someone's story that we're sharing in artwork or in the documentaries that we're making, that really involves a lot of trust building. Mm. And you don't do that from just the very transactional meetings that you have about making the film. It's all of that time, you know, having dinner, sharing space and time and your values together. And that's sort of where a lot of the work is. But of course, under sort of the different regimes that we live under, you know, only certain things are legible, like, you know, the documentary film. And so we sort of like to shift the emphasis into that type of relationship building that is really fundamental, in especially in this type of work that we do.
Yeah, no, totally. And you have a ongoing series show, Hot Pot Talks.
Yes.
Do you want to get into that a little bit?
Sure, sure. So, yeah, Hot Pot Talks, I'll connect it sort of in terms of thinking about relationships. Mm-hmm. So Hot Pot Talks grew out of it was a pandemic baby. It was one of those, you know, we when everything went into quarantine, and we wanted to continue to do work to build community. So we do also a lot of work in Chinatown. We have a studio in Chinatown. And when we got that lease, we made a commitment to do community, to do projects that serve community so that we wouldn't contribute to gentrification. And so part of what we wanted to do, and how Hot Pot Talks came, the idea came about, was, you know, we wanted to have these conversations, and we were using sort of the metaphor of the hot pot. So a hot pot as sort of, you know, communal food sharing, as community nourishment, as sharing, and using that sort of image as a way to infuse what we were trying to do in that sort of virtual space. If I may plug, we are releasing season 4. Thank you. And this one's actually filmed. So we're doing a little bit differently from the other seasons, where we actually cooked with our participants, with our interviewees.
Aww.
Yeah, to actually make food. And sort of the theme in that one is talking about ancestral knowledge as well, and thinking about like cooking and food as something that's sort of literally in our bodies from our ancestors. And so we were kind of playing with this idea of like, let's actually do that action and that ceremony, if you will, and then have the conversation after.
And that's almost like a cultural ceremony, or like,
exactly.
You were talking about cultural production a little bit earlier too.
Yeah.
Do you want to maybe define or get into what that means, like cultural production?
Sure. And I mean, I'll tie it specifically into, you know, sort of what we were talking about around. So I started talking about social practice as well. So the city of Vancouver and the arts, you know, the more mainstream art world, I don't know if I want to call it that, but there's this term called intangible arts practices. And the city of Vancouver is actually starting to name them and also include them into what they fund.
That's so interesting. Yeah.
And that's sort of what I mean, is sort of like these types of cultural practices, like different food ceremonies. You know, there's a lot of, for example, the city of Vancouver also talks about a lot of like indigenous cultural practices that are really fundamental, practices in community that really perform a really important role. And it also happens in, you know, in my community, in the Chinese community, there's a lot of ceremonies that are really important.
Mm-hmm.
But they're not like a theater piece or like a, you know. And so, yeah, that's sort of one of the things that we're also thinking about at Love Intersections as well. What is considered art? What is considered culture production? And how can we sort of push against sort of these funding bodies, if you will, and the broader systems that sort of say this is considered, you know, more valued art.
Yeah.
And this is sort of intangible. I don't even really like that term, but you know, at least it's sort of being talked about.
And I feel like that goes so much against the like capitalist structure then that you're operating under, which is like, you know, what are you producing, and the value is all put on the like your output and like how much content essentially you can produce.
Exactly.
And like manufacturing. So if you're like, actually, you know, the emphasis is on kind of the intangible stuff, building those relationships.
Exactly. Yeah.
Where it's not like you have an output, like you have a, you know, physical object that you're presenting.
And you can't sell it.
Exactly. Really, you can't commodify.
Exactly.
I mean, I'm sure someone will find a way to.
There are a lot of very wealthy white artists, white men artists that have profited off of social practice.
And touching on that, and that brings me to my next point. I was going to bring up when you said that most of your work is done in Chinatown and like around gentrification. Mm. Have you seen the film Everything Will Be by Julia Kwan?
I haven't, no.
Okay, well, that is a documentary about Chinatown, Vancouver's Chinatown. And it has, how do I say this? It's not like extremely narrative driven. It is obviously narrative driven. And there's like a couple consistent people that they talk to. And it is largely just about like, okay, like the changing quote unquote Chinatown. And like, you know, these shops are closing and these random things are popping up. But it gets into this kind of dynamic between older Chinatown residents, like shop owners, they've been there for 50, 60 years, and specifically Bob Rennie and his gallery. And they interview him quite a bit and walk through the gallery and stuff like that. And I've just been like thinking on that a lot recently, that I find it so interesting that like in Vancouver, we have this, at least in the case of Chinatown, we have this like singular figure almost we can name. And like, I'm not going to say he's solely responsible for the gentrification of Chinatown. There's a lot, there's a lot going on there, like systemic stuff. But it's like really interesting that we have this one figure we can point to and we're like, okay, you are someone that's like really contributing to this. Right. And the fact that he's an art collector. And like even in the film, he's like, I'm not a developer, I'm a curator. And like, what I'm doing is curating essentially this like Chinatown experience. But I find it, I find it so interesting that like we can, obviously like art and activism go together. There's definitely like very real ways that like they can help each other, or not even help each other. I think that at some level they're inseparable. Like they are one and the same. But it's also so interesting to think on the flip side that like it can be used like on the other side, essentially.
And I mean, in such a, you know, in so many communities across the world, and in many, you know, Chinatowns across the world, specifically in Turtle Island, North America, you know, artists are usually the front line of gentrification, right? It's I'm careful to say that too, because, you know, artists are often very precarious, you know, especially in a place like Vancouver, you know, and New York and San Francisco and LA, where rent is incredibly expensive. And so where are the cheap studios, right? And then this, but of course, you know, the cities then zone those, you know, certain areas like the downtown east side, like Chinatown, to open these studios for artists. Artists make them trendy, make them cool. Then those, you know, then different types of traffic comes in, different class of people come in who can afford to go to these nicer cafes, you know. And then it kind of spirals into, you know, as we've seen in places like Vancouver and New York. And so what we hope to do, and I don't want to say that we're a perfect example or anything, try to pretend that we're an, a model for this, but we're really intentional about how do we do work that serves community needs in the neighborhood. And so I'll just share a little bit maybe about the project we've been doing with the LIM Association. So when we moved into the studio, so our studio is in the Lim Sai Hor Khao Mak Benevolent Association building. It's a building that I know very well because, and I'm mentioning this because we talk about relationships, but I've worked in that building for like 23 years.
Wow.
Hello Cool World, the company that I've worked for since I was a teenager, a social justice marketing company, has a unit in there. So I have a relationship with the association, and they invited us to lease that studio. And so when we had this thought about, you know, okay, how do we operate our studio in a good way, really? We had long conversations with the Lim Association, and they brought to us that, you know, actually, I'll tell you the story. So basically, we had a meeting with the elders, and one of my colleagues, Emily, pointed to these like really a shelf of really old books, and said, you know, these are really beautiful. And one of the elders was like, you know, we would really love to digitize this work.
Right.
And then another elder said, you know, we'd really love to have a website. And so, of course, as you know, nerdy artists, we get very excited about archives. And so we got some grants to archive, to digitize the work, and we built a website. But then we also started doing, we got another grant after to record oral histories. And so we did a series of oral history recordings, and then that sort of culminated into an exhibit that just closed at Massey Gallery called The House of Nine Dragons. And I'll just connect it to what you were talking about also. We were talking about Chinatown. And in terms of relationships, you know, like love intersections, you know, I'm mentioning all of these sort of intentions that we have around, you know, the concerns about gentrification, the solidarity that we try to cultivate with our neighbors in the Downtown East Side as well. And we've done a lot of work with the Downtown East Side Heart of the City Festival. That's not always shared in the Chinatown neighborhood by other Chinese people as well. You know, there's, you know, without naming names, but, you know, there's a lot of, well, you know, as we've, you know, as we've seen with a lot of the gentrification battles, right? 105 Kiefer being the most recent one. There's a lot of different, different political beliefs in the neighborhood. And so, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is when Jen and I and our collaborators at Love Intersections, when we try to create art in the neighborhood, we also recognize that that's going to be an encounter of Jen and my stories and our intentions, but also with the people that we work with. And so what we hope, what we hope is that that story comes through. You know, the House of Nine Dragons, our hope of it was, you know, thinking about, you know, these oral histories and these stories that the elders are bringing forward. So in thinking about like the stories that the elders are bringing into that exhibit, you know, when we think about the past, when we think about memory, especially when we think about memory of like systemic oppression and racism, What is that doing to transform today and to the future, right?
Like, instead of just re-traumatizing, like, how can we use this to open dialogue?
And
or, like, not just dialogue, but, like, create a change instead of just, like, this thing.
Yeah, exactly. And so that's what we hope, you know, in with that exhibit and sort of the more work that we're doing in Chinatown. You know, Chinatown was a neighborhood of segregation.
Yeah.
And so what do we do with that history and not just sort of look at it insular? I'm speaking as a Chinese person who has history in family history in Chinatown, but how do we actually connect that to the systems of, you know, I'll name them colonialism and anti-Indigenous, anti-Black racism, but how do we connect it to those histories so that we're not just, so that those systems are being talked about or thought about, and not just, you know, insularly looking at the history as sort of something that has just happened in the past, because those systems continue today.
Yeah. Not to ask you a difficult question,
no,
but
please.
How do you think art can be kind of that bridge between like taking something from history or looking at something from a historical perspective and like bringing it into the present and like change making? How is art related to that process, I guess?
Yeah, so two things come to mind. So I believe, and it's not just me, many other artists talk about this, but art doesn't live in a vacuum.
Yeah.
You know, artists have always been a reflection of the world.
Yeah.
So I think there's a responsibility and accountability attached to that. The second part is, and I'm mentioning this because I just finished a book chapter today. I'm a part of the Transformative Memory Network at UBC Social Justice Institute. It's a research network. And so we've been writing, I've been writing about this. I'm designing a curatorial concept with Alejandra Gaviria, a PhD colleague of mine, about these artworks that have come from activities from places where there's been mass violence. Mm-hmm. So Colombia, Northern Ireland, Uganda, Canada, and other regions. But sort of the sort of premise of what the network is thinking about, though, is sort of what I just mentioned. So in thinking about memory, mm-hmm. how do we not, and horrible things that have happened in the past, like what we, you know, connected to Chinatown again, but that type of segregation and indentured labor.
Yeah.
What is the purpose of those memories if it doesn't actually, you know, change the ways that we, our relationships to those systems that produced it, right? And so I think, to answer your question, art has a way, is a way that we can create those angles or mm-hmm. those perspectives or those mirrors, if you will. I'll give a very specific example, just, you know, like when we think about those systems of segregation and exclusion to Chinese people, right? Mm-hmm. That was a part of colonizing Canada.
Yeah.
The indentured labor of Chinese people and, you know, of Asians was for the purpose of colonization. It's built upon anti-Indigenous and anti-Black racism. Those systems are still very present today. You know, mm-hmm. they may take shape in a different form.
Yeah.
And so I think art can show us that, you know,
yeah.
and or sort of illuminate that, if you will. It's there. It's still the backbone of our world, unfortunately. And so art has a way, I think, of kind of shining light on that and giving sort of different ways of thinking about those regimes and how we might imagine a new world.
Mm-hmm. I heard once or I read once that art is, like, art history is just history because art is history, like, mm-hmm. fundamentally, mm-hmm. especially, like, the first thing that comes to mind with that is, like, oh, yeah, because, you know, in the olden days or whatever, like, they didn't have photos, so everything is art. But more than that, because, like we were talking about cultural production earlier, like, what art is being produced and what art is being bought, what art is being rediscovered, mm-hmm. like, the styles, what's being portrayed, like, all of those things that you would talk about in, like, an art history analysis, mm-hmm. you're actually analyzing essentially, like, the culture of the day. Like, absolutely. How popular was this artist relative to their time? And, like, what are they talking about? Why was this popular? Why was this, you know, what people are talking about? And so it's so interesting, I guess, to make art with the reflection of that culture and the reflection of culture in order to make change in mind from the very beginning, because mm-hmm. I think it happens, like, incidentally anyways, mm-hmm. but for that to be the aim, I guess, yeah, I don't know if you have anything on that as someone that is, like, actively doing that. Do you think it changes the art making experience, or do you think that, you know, you were kind of, you would get to the same art either way?
That, you know, I'm not sure, because, you know, it's, despite having started Love Intersections 10 years ago, I don't really have a quote-unquote formal art training, mm-hmm. and I've delved into a more quote-unquote formal art, or at least art history, because of this PhD,
yeah, for sure.
where I'm doing, you know, where I'm thinking about race and social justice, and having to sort of situate it at least in mm-hmm. art history. Yeah, I don't know if I have the answer to
and
that
question.
And that's
okay. I don't have the answer either.
But I'll just say, I mean, yeah, I mean, art, you know, from aesthetic theory and art history is deeply tied to to colonialism, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a place there, you know, when how we started this conversation around what is considered art and what isn't, what is legible in the art world and what isn't. That is all deeply linked to...
Totally.
to colonial history. And so, you know, I think it's why we really like to center that conversation about social practice and community engaged art, mm-hmm. because in a way it also allows us to unpack and center, you know, a different nexus of colonialism that we're trying to sort of push against.
Yeah. No, it's so interesting to think about art specifically in this case, because it's like art is such, like, it takes so many shapes and so many definitions, because it's mm-hmm. like, on one side, the like mainstream art world is just so embedded in like mm-hmm. so many structures that are like, no,
yeah.
like, it's so terrible. Like, even Bob Rennie, we were talking about earlier, like, kind of that push in like the last 10-ish years of, I can't think of the word for it right now, but like bringing pieces from museums back to like
a repatriation.
Yes, thank yeah. you, repatriation. Yeah. yeah. Or like even like all the discourse around like separating the art from the artist or whatever. Like, these conversations have always been had, and like mm-hmm. the more popular art is, the more, or like a certain type of art or a certain artist is, the more, you know, they're reinforcing those, you know, class structures, mm-hmm. everything we've been talking about.
Yeah.
But on the other side, like, what is good art if not art that's going against the mainstream, right? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. what, like, good art inherently shouldn't be reproducing everything that you're already seeing. It's
right.
supposed to be, you know, innovative and avant-garde and all these things.
Totally.
But if that's what it's supposed to be and it's doing that, isn't that, once again, reinforcing kind of what it's supposed to be doing?
Right.
So it's like, it's yeah. like this big like paradox of like, what is good art and how do you make it?
Yeah.
And then is it too good and you need to like do it differently?
Or, totally.
You know, it's so interesting. But one of the key figures in that documentary I was talking about, Everything Will Be, is an artist who moves to Chinatown, and he's like of Chinese heritage. But I don't think he's lived in Chinatown before, and he gets a studio for a year, and he's like, I'm going to do it. Like, this is me. You know, I saved up my money. I'm going to try to do it. And at the end of the year, he has to, you know, close down his shop.
Right.
But he, like, one of the things he was talking about in the couple times they interviewed him is, like, he really wanted to find that, like, nice middle ground, like, walk that tightrope of, like, you know, upholding the values and the heritage of Chinatown, while also kind of bringing some energy into it in like an artistic way. And his art was very like lots of like sculptures and DIY and like interesting, almost like performance-y stuff.
Cool.
Like, it was, yeah, it was interesting.
Cool.
I can't think of his name right now, but oh, I can think of his first name. His first name is Ken. I can't think of his last name, but yeah, maybe I can find more details for you on that.
Cool.
But it was really interesting to have him come in and like really make an effort to do like good art that is, you know, going against the mainstream, that is like holding up his personal values as well as the values of the community that he's in, like doing all these things. And then by the end of that year, no, like, doesn't work out.
Yeah.
Even though he's made these really great relationships with the community members. And then versus like Bob Rennie's gallery, like standing there and ever expanding.
Yeah.
And
I'll share with you, we kind of got a, there was a piece that we did, it's just what you're sharing comes to mind. So this was when we launched Hot Pot Talks, and this was at sort of the height of the Stop Asian Hate stuff that was happening during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
One of the frustrations that we had was that there was a lot of Asian organizing for Stop Asian Hate that was very pro-police. It was a big, lots of placards, and a lot of the at the rallies said stuff like, you know, we are citizens too. We contribute to Canada too, as sort of like this.
The bid for inclusion rather than the.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so we released at Lunar New Year a couple years ago these red envelopes that said defund, disarm, disband the police.
Nice.
And we got some flack for it.
Yeah.
And it was largely from Chinese people who said that, you know, these envelopes are supposed to, you know, it's not supposed to be political.
Mm.
It's not supposed to be political, and it's supposed to be celebratory. It's supposed to be happy. And I mentioned that because this is sort of exactly what we're trying to do, right? Is, you know, the paradigm of what is considered happy and not political.
Right.
Is in fact political.
Yeah.
You know, I'm, I'll also just name, you know, the controversy recently for the Chinatown parade, where there was a group, I think a couple groups of Chinatown organizers that were excluded from the parade. It was a whole debacle where they were excluded, then included, then excluded, then included. And the letter and the wording of it was, we don't, you know, it was this idea that you guys are too political, right? Mm. When in fact, so we were tearing down our exhibit that day, and I opened the door. So on in Chinatown, the first thing I saw were literally military vehicles, like a whole bunch of military vehicles, right? And so two things, right? You're saying you're not political when clearly you're political. Second of all, by not being political, by being the by being neutral, you are actually upholding the status quo, which is political.
Yeah,
right?
I was going
to
say.
So I don't know where I'm going on this tangent, but it's maybe just connecting it back into sort of back into sort of the possibilities of art, right? I think what we were hoping to do with those red envelopes and also in our practice is that sort of reframing, right? In by making something that might actually cause some might be a little bit challenging. But hopefully it encourages a dialogue towards thinking about some of these things that we hope will be changed.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
Like policing.
Yeah, and I feel like that is something that maybe can be kind of difficult to navigate, is like, how can we connect our activism to these, like, you know, long upheld traditions and cultures and stuff like that, and involve, like, you know, intergenerational happenings. But then it's also like, not everyone is willing to be involved.
Yeah.
Like, quite simply, not everyone wants to maybe feel the discomfort that comes with not subscribing to the status quo.
Right.
And like you said, like, the concept of being, oh, I'm not a political person, that is political in itself, because you're picking the side, and the side you're picking is like to not advocate for change in a super corrupted system. But it's also like, you know, how much is it our responsibility almost to try and convince people to engage? And it's like, is more willing engagement better? But then it's like, okay, but more engagement in general is better. So it's kind of that, like, navigating that as well. And I think, sorry, I was just gonna say, like, I think we are seeing, like, a little bit some of that with, for example, the encampment right now on UBC campus, the encampment for Palestine, as well as, I actually just learned, sorry, this is a side note, but I just learned that now there are student encampments and movements for Palestine on all seven continents.
Yes, I saw that. Even in Antarctica,
yeah,
I saw.
Yeah, it's not awesome.
Yeah, yeah,
so,
amazing.
But I feel like, I don't know, I think this is something that I've said before that I maybe in hindsight wouldn't say again, but like, oh, like this time of you know, this time of tension, da, da, da. But it's like, okay, that's always there's always things going on. But I think that, like, when I say, like, oh, this time of tension, like, how are we navigating this, like, in this time, I mean, like, literally, like, today, like, literally, like, this week, like, I guess what I'm asking you in this very roundabout way is how do you see that, like, structure of, like, trying to do art and, like, art as activism and, like, keep it intergenerational and keep it kind of, like, true to the values you're trying to uphold or trying to uphold when there's, like, so much going on. Like, there's just so many conversations being had right now. And right now as in, like, currently this month.
Totally.
Do you find it, like, overwhelming to see all of the things going on, or do you find it positive and, like, uplifting to see, like, I guess... community in solidarity.
I think there's a couple of things that come to mind. I am thinking about the encampment, of course, because I spent the day there yesterday, and I think about and just thinking about art and activism, you know, and sort of what we were talking about before in terms of what is legible and what isn't community engaged art, but and cultural production. But so, I mean, art and artists have always been at the forefront of social movements. You know, I can think of a million examples, but, like, you know, even the keffiyeh, for example, you know, the symbolism and the art in the keffiyeh, the olive leaves, the fishnet, the trading routes that are in the keffiyeh that is now is a symbol of Palestinian liberation. All that, you know, that artwork and that heritage that is fundamental to now to the identity of sort, you know, of the movement, that's art, right? Mm-hmm. I think about the, you know, there was an auntie who made makluba and shared it in the middle of the, actually, yeah. it was actually quite lovely because it was in the middle of some of the organizing and safety instruction or conversation. Mm-hmm. You know, an auntie came and had this, you know, makluba, which is the dish where you flip it. And it was this beautiful, and that's also art, and that's also a cultural production.
Yeah.
And so that's always been sort of the backbone of social movements is art and cultural production. Sorry, what was the other part of your question?
Oh, I was just saying about like trying to involve different generations or different cultures into that.
Yeah. I'm thinking of this because I'm teaching my first course ever.
Oh my gosh, yes.
The Vancouver Summer Program. It's a course called Creativity in the Margins. And
cool.
One of the things that I've been thinking about, and I borrow this from Out in Schools. And so, you know, Jen used to be the used to run Out in Schools. Jen of Love Intersections used to run Out in Schools. That's how we met. She hired me as a facilitator. And how Out in Schools open presentations is, you know, how could your story change the world? Mm. And I love that so much because, you know, they're using film and stories to connect around, mm-hmm. you know, LGBTQ to spirit, you know, themes.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's also a question of it disrupts this idea of what, you know, this idea that only certain people with a highfalutin type of art history training can be artists
yeah.
too. And sort of makes me anyways think of like the different parts in my life and a part of my story that could be used or that could be expressed
mm-hmm.
As art
mm-hmm.
To share my story, but also, you know, I often think about love intersections anyways and artwork, but how as stories that encounter each other. And so even though I might have an intention actually to connect it to the encampment again,
yeah.
You know, for example, I'll give a very specific example. You know, when we made the film Carla and Haifa, it was like our second film. It's a queer Palestinian person and their mother, and it's about their relationship. You know, that film, and I've taken it, it's screened at festivals all over the world, but I remember when it screened in Japan, it brought up a big conversation about trans and non-binary inclusion, mm-hmm. which was not what we made as the filmmaker,
yeah.
for example, like specifically in my mind
had
that idea of what it was going to be. But of course, when it encounters another story or another community,
mm-hmm.
it's going to, you know, cultivate a different type of conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So I think about that a lot, right? Like, you know, and this is what I hope to bring into that course as well, that, you know, yes, we're looking at artists, but, you know, how are also ways that, you know, outside of just the text that we're often forced to write, especially as humanities students, but how else can we express what we're trying to do or what we're trying to say in a way that is, that could change the world?
No, that's so, the last point that you said, I feel like, and it's the same thing with art as with academia, but it's like the more you kind of churn over these themes and these ideas and intellectualize them, and then it's like, okay, but how can we connect this back to the ground? Like actually remember that like what we're doing is work that is like being done in person probably and like has a tangible effect and is not just like, you know, you can write an awesome 30-page paper about whatever you want to, but then it's like, you know, if no one ever reads that and it doesn't, you know, inspire anybody.
Yeah.
And you don't progress further in your like revelations,
right,
that you're taking it and like doing work with it, that like the most you've ever thought about this issue, and then you just put it on paper, you put it in a box, you put it away, you know, how much is that really doing to help, as opposed to somebody who maybe isn't as like educated on like the correct terms to use or the correct, you know, history of whatever, but they're there and they're like giving out donations, mm-hmm, and they're, mm-hmm, you know, helping people in like real life.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. It's definitely something, I guess, to be aware of. I don't want to say cautious of, but aware of, especially for people like us that like kind of work in these spheres of like, we're doing activist work, but also like we're having a lot of meetings and a lot of conversations and we're writing things down and we're putting them in places, and just like, I guess, remembering to like, who are we actually here to help?
Yeah, exactly. Who's it for? You know, and it's a big part of what I'm thinking about for my dissertation as well, is, you know, a question that I have is like, you know, what could a decolonial queer of color arts practice look like?
Yeah.
How can this dissertation actually serve the indigenous,
mm-hmm,
how can it serve the, you know, the fight for indigenous sovereignty here? It's sort of something that I think is important to sort of foreground in all of the work that we do.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And if people wanted to reach you at Love Intersections or get involved, how would they do that? Do you want to plug your organization?
Yeah, sure. So follow us. Instagram's probably the best. So Love Intersections on Instagram. And we have, we post all of our work through there. So yeah, get in touch.
Sweet. Well, thank you so much for coming to talk to me today. I had a lovely time. Really good conversation. Okay.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you so much.
The Bite Kitchen welcomes you to Access Night, a weekly event in the shop offering free tool rentals for queer and trans folks, with the purpose being to make bike mechanics more inviting and accessible to folks traditionally excluded from the industry. Visit the Bite Kitchen on Wednesdays from 6:15 to 9 p.m., located in the basement of the Life Building. We hope to see you there.
In the context of Vancouver's opioid crisis, CITR would like to take a moment to share some harm reduction strategies.
Try not to do drugs alone. When going out, let friends know what drugs you're taking and make sure someone has an naloxone kit. If you're able to, get your drugs tested before taking them.
Avoid mixing opioids with alcohol or stimulants. Remember that opioids can include painkillers prescribed by a doctor, and it's possible for any drugs to be contaminated with opioids.
Learn the signs of opioid overdose, which include, but are not limited to, unresponsiveness or unconsciousness, inability to speak, breathing that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, heartbeat that is slow, erratic, or has stopped completely, skin tone that has turned blue or gray, choking or gurgling sounds.
If you think someone is overdosing, call 911 immediately. Start rescue breathing and administer naloxone if you have it. You cannot get in trouble for being on drugs, so always call 911 in an emergency.
For more information about naloxone kits and training, visit towardtheheart.com.
Thank you and stay safe.
All right, welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. My name is Serena. You're listening to The Arts Report, and you just heard an interview with David Ng of Love Intersections. Huge thank you to David, and a huge thank you to Charlotte Cornfield as well. This is just about the end of our show, so just want to wish everybody a very nice evening, and I'll see you again soon.
Change is necessary, inevitably. Kelalalelam is an urban indigenous health and wellness cooperative in Vancouver's downtown east side. Taking a decolonized approach to healthcare, Kelalalelam aims to partner.
We would like to acknowledge that the land on which CITR operates and broadcast, and where many of you are listening to the program from, is the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam people.
Hello and welcome to that song from that movie. I'm Movie Maverick Mike.
And I'm Logan the Extra. Today we'll be talking about Drive and the song Night Call by Gravinsky.
In 2011, Ryan Gosling and director Nicholas Winding Refn set out to make a movie that was more about a stunt driver than the stunts. And they built a story around criminal activity.